This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, April 8th, 2003. Monday, April 7th.
Ace, Maya.
No, Monday was April 7th.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
In a residential area of Baghdad, the Al-Mansur district of western Baghdad, an upper middle-class residential district, not one of the working-class districts of Baghdad, U.S. Air Force warplane, the B-1 bomber, dropped four Bunker Buster JDAM 2,000-pound bombs on an apartment building. Supposedly, according to NBC News, there was extremely reliable intelligence that indicated that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and one or both of his sons were attending a meeting. Devastation. Devastation so forceful that all that was left was an enormous crater. What is this JDAM that is so discussed antiseptically on CNN and on NBC, and that the Pentagon promotes in a way that is unbearable when you look at the devastation? David Wood, for the Newhouse News Service, put out an article, New Workhorse of the U.S. Military, A Bomb with Devastating Effects. As we discuss this, the JDAM, and other carnage throughout Iraq on today's Taking Aim, carnage, the real face of the war, the face of the war that we don't see in our newspapers and on the television, the true face, the intended policy of the U.S. Pentagon. New Workhorse of U.S. Military, A Bomb with Devastating Effects. It will fall silently and unseen from the distant sky, writes David Wood, a cigar-shaped steel capsule hurtling down at 300 miles per hour with a single deadly purpose. In the final moments, there might come a brief, chilling whirr as tiny gears adjust its tail fins to nudge it closer to its target.
Maya, this is the weapon that has been chortled over by Rumsfeld and by Bush himself, and which the U.S. Defense Department calls Bug Splat. The software program has that very title, Bug Splat, the work, as the Newhouse article describes, of a 2,000-pound Mark 84 JDAM, the workhorse of the U.S. military, in nanoseconds releasing a crushing shockwave and showering jagged, white-hot metal fragments at supersonic speed, shredding flesh, I'm quoting, crushing cells, rupturing lungs, bursting sinus cavities, and ripping away limbs in a maelstrom of destruction, a critical factor of the U.S. weaponry in this war of genocidal devastation in Iraq.
Now, the JDAM has been used for decades, but what is new is that they've inserted a navigation system that's controlled by the GPS, that is, the satellite navigation. Who makes the JDAM? None other than Boeing. Familiar to everyone here in the United States is the manufacturer of the airplanes, commercial airplanes, but also Boeing is a huge manufacturer of missiles and weaponry, such as the Bunker Buster, the JDAMs. But let's look at some of the carnage, because the JDAM blasts clear, wide areas, such as we see now in Baghdad.
But Maya, it should be pointed out that this JDAM is used in conjunction with another weapon, and they don't report this, something called a MOAB, the Massive Ordnance Airburst, which blasts clear huge areas, hundreds of yards across. In fact, they're reaching up to as much as three-quarters of a mile. And as you recall, when we were in Beirut during the Israeli destruction of Beirut on lines that are similar to that which is being enforced inflicted today on Baghdad. The implosion weapon that the Israeli used was an earlier version of this JDAM and Moab arsenal. Such is the high-flaring magnesium detonation of these weapons that it sucks all the oxygen out of the air and disintegrates the structures below.
As is noted in David Wood's article that can be seen on the internet at www.newhousenews.com in their archive, the ensuing chemical reaction produces an expanding nucleus of hot gas that swells the Mark 84's 14-inch wide cast steel casing to almost twice its size before the steel shears and fractures, showering 1,000 pounds of white-hot steel fragments at 6,000 feet per second and driving a shockwave of several thousand pounds per square inch.
As they describe it, Maya, instantly a fireball lashes out at 8,500 degrees Fahrenheit and the explosion gouges 20-foot craters and hurls 10,000 pounds of rocket debris at supersonic speed.
Now, what does this mean? We have been discussing 8,500 degrees Fahrenheit. We've been discussing craters, but this has incredible consequences for the people on the ground, the victims of this U.S. genocidal policy. Trauma physicians confronting the human wreckage divide casualties into four classes. One is injury from the blast itself, mostly caused by the pressure wave, 100 times or more the injury threshold of 15 pounds per square inch. By comparison, a shockwave of 12 psi will knock over a standing person. But as we mentioned before, what you have here is the white-hot steel fragments at 6,000 feet per second, and the shockwave is several thousand pounds per square inch.
The blast force shatters glass and drives legal fragments 120 miles per hour. The metal fragments travel 3,800 feet, three-quarters of a mile. The bigger fragments, heavy pieces of thick metal nose cones, sail out for a mile and a half. A third set of injuries results as bodies are picked up and thrown against a part of a stationary body ripped away. A fourth class takes in everything, including burns from the fireball and incredible crush injuries from falling debris. These are all what we are describing here, quotations from the Newhouse article particularizing the meaning of this weaponry. Almost anyone who survives the blast injuries...
No one survives, Ralph.
You're quite right. You're quite right, Maya. It states here, almost no one survives primary blast injuries, experts say. The brutal shock wave, a force that far exceeds the pressure the atmosphere applies to the human body, smashes into and explodes body cavities, lungs, colon, bowels, even through the sinuses and the skull. The pressure bursts individual cells and ruptures critical blood vessels, forcing air through them and into the heart and brain, causing instant death. You don't treat consequences of this primary overpressure, said Dr. Michael McCauley, a physician and professor of public health at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, the type of force that picks you up and throws you where you get traumatic amputations, you're already dead from the blast.
And then severe burns from the fireball. People lose chunk of flesh to flying debris and their limbs are crushed.
The crushing breaks open muscle cells, dumping the contents into capillaries and clogging critical blood vessels. McCauley stated, cardiac problems, kidney failure immediately result. In a poor country like Iraq, you don't survive these crush injuries. Severe burns from the fireball, losing chunks of flesh to flying debris, crushed limbs. It is torment. It is torture. It is total. It is devastating. 95% of the victims of these blasts do not survive them. Those who survive are bleeding from lacerations and from perforation in every part of the body, and they die an agonizing death. This is a cold but accurate and precise description of the weaponry that is being dropped in Baghdad and in other centers across Iraq.
So when NBC reports that on April 7th, yesterday, four JDAMs were launched against an apartment building in Baghdad, and when the reporter says there may not be survivors, of course there are no survivors. People could have been vaporized by the strike. Vaporized is only a mild way of discussing what we have now elaborated. JDAMs, JDAMs throughout Iraq.
And what does it mean to talk about chemical weapons? What does it mean to talk about weapons of mass destruction when this is the particular arsenal of the United States in every part of Iraq? 2,000 B-1 and B-52 bombers in the skies at a single moment over Baghdad. 2,000 destructive aircraft dropping this type of weaponry on the city of Baghdad, even as in Mosul and Kirkuk and in the smaller cities of Iraq. It is a genocidal devastation of the population and the infrastructure of the society.
From 6 a.m. Saturday to 6 a.m. Sunday, this past weekend, according to CNN, there were 1,850 airstrikes. There were 100 casualties per hour in the airport and in Baghdad alone. This is not even throughout Iraq. 100 casualties per hour. This doesn't account for all the people who were killed as a result of these JDAMs and the other horrendous bombs and missiles launched against the population.
And what are the descriptions of the carnage below? The descriptions that you don't find on CNN and NBC. Hospitals buckle as casualties escalate, writes Charles Hanley in the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia on April 7th. Baghdad's hard-pressed surgeons are flooded with the wounded, amputating the limbs of children and adults with no anesthetics to block the pain and few antibiotics to protect the patients. We don't have drugs. I saw it myself. Dr. Demetrius Mogni's account after a day of touring hospitals during the bombing of the capital is a first-hand substantiation of the report by the World Health Organization. Baghdad is without anesthetics, analgesics, and surgical items. The International Committee of the Red Cross in Baghdad reported that hundreds of wounded have been brought into city hospitals since Friday alone. 100 bombing casualties a day at one hospital alone. The hospitals are finding it impossible to cope with the influx of the wounded, the Red Cross's Muin Qasi stated. The ICRC has voiced grave concern over access to hospitals south of Baghdad following devastation across the country. Red Cross staff in Baghdad say they cannot help the victims in Hila, Karbala, Nasiriyah, and Najaf. They are too many. The facilities are too few. The surgeons, the anesthesia, the antibiotics are non-existent. Red Cross spokesman Roland Hugan and Benjamin visited a hospital in Hila, south of Baghdad. The doctors are overwhelmed with civilian casualties. Loads and loads of dead bodies dismembered by the violence of the explosions to which they have been subjected. This is a horrific sight. A general practitioner from Athens, who has traveled 16 times to Iraq since 1993, said he has never seen anything on this scale. Children's hospitals devastated, burn cases, amputations, severe internal injuries, no anesthesia for amputations, short on any general anesthesia, pentotol, nitrous oxide. They're using ketamine, a 5-minute anesthetic, for the amputations. The surgical teams are injecting child patients with ketamine every few minutes to maintain effects. The shortages extend across the rack to gauze, tetanus vaccine, or any antibiotics to protect patients against infection.
In fact, Ralph, in Baghdad, they don't even have the ketamine. They are using 800 milligrams of ibuprofen. Ibuprofen, that is Advil here in the United States. Ibuprofen for amputations. And Le Monde on March 5th reports that this terrible bombardment has been called by the American general, Michael Mosley, a complicated ballet. Complicated Ballet is what he talks about, the way he describes the 2,000 planes that are above Iraq. 2,000 planes launched from 5 aircraft carriers and 30 bases in 12 different countries. 40,000 personnel mobilized just for the aerial strikes. And this is not the people on the ground. 40,000 personnel for this genocidal assault from the air.
Maya, the Red Cross on April 5th, just to amplify what you're saying, the headline in the story, Red Cross horrified by the numbers of dead civilians. Red Cross doctors across southern Iraq saw, quote, incredible levels of civilian casualties, truckloads of dismembered women and children, a spokesman said Thursday in Baghdad. Roland Huganin, one of 6 international Red Cross doctors in the Iraqi capital, said that they are horrified by the casualties in Hila. There is an incredible number of casualties with grave wounds in Hila and across southern Iraq. Trucks are delivering hundreds of totally dismembered bodies of women and children. It is an awful sight. It is very difficult to believe the scale on which this is happening, the article goes on.
Yes, they say doctors worked around the clock to do as much as they could, but that's all they could manage. That's all they can try to do. They've toddlers of 2 or 3 years of age who've lost their legs, their arms. As the Red Cross says, we have called this a horror. And where did the people from Hila come from? They came from the village of Nasiriyah. Now, this led Amnesty International, as well as the Red Cross, to disclose that many of these injuries were caused by cluster bombs. As the Amnesty International press release on April 2nd notes, on April 1st, many of the people coming into the hospitals around the town of Al-Hila were children, and that they were children and they had been attacked by cluster bombs. And Amnesty International is precise. The cluster bomblets used around Al-Hila are the BLU-97A/B. And each canister contains 202 small bomblets, the size of a small soft drink can. The cluster bomblets scatter over a large area, approximately the size of 2 football fields. Imagine this. One bomb spreading over 2 football fields.
You're talking about 10,000 slivers of razor-sharp steel, lacerating flesh like a machete. You're talking about thousands of BB-sized metal balls that perforate organs and render a pancreas and liver and kidney like a sieve. The victims inoperable. ABC News on the 6th of April, Red Cross, the Iraqi wounded are too high to count. The number of casualties in Baghdad, the report states, is so high that the hospital has stopped counting the numbers of people treated, the International Committee of the Red Cross said Sunday. No one can keep an accurate statistic on the admitted and transferred. It is truckloads of amputees and decimated bodies. Ambulances are picking up the wounded and running them in the triage areas into hospitals. The neutral Swiss-run organization, ABC reports, the main agency left in Iraq, gave estimates of between 2,000 and 3,000 civilians reaching over the weekend alone in 2 hospitals. All the hospitals are under pressure. The medical staff is working without respite. It is an indication of the magnitude of the civilian slaughter in Iraq.
And Ralph, to go back to the cluster bombs, because Ralph has been describing the injuries that are taking place now from the JDAMs, from the cluster bombs, from the missile attacks that are coming from the tanks on the ground. But what Amnesty International notes, that at least 5% of the cluster bombs are duds. They don't explode on impact, and this turns them into anti-personnel mines because they pose a threat to people who come in contact with them. And we had described this last week, such as happened in Lebanon and in Afghanistan and Kosovo and areas throughout the world. And Ralph had described this goes all the way back to Vietnam. But what the United Nations has disclosed and what the United States continually denies is that these cluster bombs that end up in the fields throughout Iraq and in the villages are covered in a bright yellow plastic wrap, and that the color of the wrapping is identical to the food packets, identical to the food packets that were used throughout Afghanistan, and that children confuse the ration and the unexploded ordnance because of the identical coloring. And in Afghanistan, the food packets were dropped from airplanes, and just like the cluster bombs are dropped from airplanes. So when the kids see these packages on the ground, they pick them up, and there you have further lacerations, further amputations, if the children manage to survive.
Paul Peachy in The Independent, this is virtually a day-by-day account of genocidal slaughter. Here on the 7th of April yesterday is Paul Peachy in The Independent. Baghdad doctors overwhelmed, 100 patients an hour. Hospitals in Baghdad are overwhelmed by the huge numbers of the wounded brought in. Medical staff working round the clock without breaks are also hampered by power cuts, the absence of clean water. One doctor, Osama Salah Dulami, who has witnessed two previous wars, stated, "I have been a doctor for 25 years. This is the worst I have seen in terms of casualty numbers and fatal wounds."
Now, let us look at what the Marines on the ground are also doing. An amazing, revealing report was published in the Times in London on Sunday, March 30th. It's by Mark Franchetti, and he's reporting from Nasiriyah. U.S. Marines turn fire on civilians at the Bridge of Death. Now, Mark Franchetti was an eyewitness to what took place, and it is riveting, it is horrifying, and it proceeds as follows. Some 15 vehicles, including a minivan and a couple of trucks, were blocking the road. They were riddled with bullet holes. Some had caught fire, and others were turned into piles of black, twisted metal. Others were still burning. Among the wreckage, I counted 12 dead, lying in the road or in nearby ditches. All had been trying to leave, that is, evacuate the southern town overnight, probably for fear of being killed by the U.S. helicopter attacks and the heavy artillery. One man's body was still in flames. It gave out a hissing sound. Down the road, a little girl no older than 5 and dressed in a pretty orange and gold dress lay dead in a ditch next to the body of a man who may have been her father. Half his head was missing. Now, the quotes from the Corporal Ryan Dupre. "The Iraqis are sick people, and we are the chemotherapy. Wait till I get a hold of a friggin' Iraqi. No, I won't get hold of one. I'll just kill him."
"I saw the heads of my two little girls come off," the Sydney Morning Herald. An Iraqi mother describes how her two young daughters were decapitated. The children's father was also killed. "I saw the heads of my two little girls come off. I watched their heads come off their bodies. My son is dead." And then in Reuters, U.S. raid hits Iraqi hospital, multiple casualties. U.S. missiles struck a Red Crescent maternity hospital in Baghdad and other civilian buildings on Wednesday, killing many people, hospital sources and witnesses said. The correspondent saw burnt out and twisted cars halted in the middle of the road, drivers burnt to death inside. U.S. planes pounded central Baghdad, hitting residential districts, wounding and killing civilians. beyond the ability to count. Again, the carnage is described in Reuters, in the Sydney Morning Herald, in the Scotsman. Rattled and exhausted, the residents of Baghdad are sure the end is nigh. And in this article again, the bombardment is horrific. It is the worst and the most powerful we have ever experienced. They are going from house to house with their bombs. They are destroying our residential neighborhoods. Our people are being dismembered. They are being burnt alive. The Scotsman on April 5th.
And the report in the Times by Mark Franchetti in Nasiriya describes what the Marines are doing throughout the town. He says many, including children, are gunned down. And a few minutes later, U.S. mortar shells land in front of the houses, going right into the houses, and an entire family is dead. Cobra helicopters fire at a row of houses. There are massive explosions and then it doesn't stop there. And he says, he just goes on and describes a bloody, bloody attack after bloody attack.
Maya, the International Court, Article 8 of the Rome Statute for the purpose of determining war crimes, intentionally launching attacks in the knowledge that these attacks will cause loss or life or injury to civilians, damage civilian objectives, or widespread long-term and severe damage to the natural environment, which is excessive in relation to the concrete and overall military advantage, attacking or bombardment by whatever means, towns, villages, buildings, undefended, which are not military targets or objectives. Now, this weak and lame international law, which never is applicable to the imperial powers of the day, nonetheless defines the very nature of the genocidal wars, the permanent wars, the continuous wars, the wars of devastation. And let it be said very clearly that all the mewling and whining about inspections, these inspections by the United Nations were designed to render this country defenseless. There is nothing that the Iraqi military, let alone population, can do to defend themselves against this rain of death. There's no anti-aircraft capacity. The Iraqis lack an air force. This is not a war. This is a slaughter. This is a deliberated slaughter for which years and years of stripping this people of the capacity to survive in their civilian infrastructure destroyed by sanctions is conjoined to the elimination of weapons not of mass destruction but of self-defense of an oppressed, impoverished victim people. That is the nature of imperial conquest. That is the real face of imperial war.
And the Marines and the U.S. military, the infantry, the battalions, they give themselves names that make it seem like it's a football game, that they're out there to run a relay race, and it's presented on the TV, on CNN, on MSNBC, on Fox TV, on CBS, ABC, as if we're keeping score at the Super Bowl. Cyclone Company lived up to its motto, according to Jeffrey Mohan of the LA Times. Tear it up. That's the motto of Cyclone Company. And what he says, they engage in dawn to dusk destruction. They left a long trail of smoking wreckage, some of it exploding long after their tanks had left the roadways about 10 miles south of Baghdad. And then in the Washington Post, Rich Atkinson, after first skirting Karbala, the army now aims to take it, he reports, on Sunday, April 6th. And his report reads as follows. The battle for Karbala began this morning with a half dozen airstrikes using satellite-guided JDAM bombs against paramilitary arsenals. It's a beautiful morning, said Colonel Joseph Anderson, the lean, intense commander of the 2nd Brigade of the 101st Airborne Division. Kiowas, Blackhawks, JDAMs, mortars, smoke.
Maya, on NBC and on CNN, the residential neighborhoods of Iraq were described as target-rich areas. Target-rich areas, referring nominally to an office here or a meeting place there of the leadership of the government of Iraq. The target-rich areas are universally residential areas of Baghdad. Not all the press is embedded. Not all the journalists belong to the National Pentagon Radio or television. George Monbiot in today's Guardian, chemical hypocrites. The U.S. is ready to use weapons banned in Iraq. And it describes how chemical weapons are a staple of the American arsenal. And it states, quote, last week, George Bush authorized U.S. troops to use gas in Iraq. Permitted to do so by an executive order published in 1975 by Gerald Ford, which overrides within the U.S. the 1925 Geneva Protocol on chemical weapons. Chemical hypocrites, the article continues, Rumsfeld, the former chief executive, G.D. Searle, one of the biggest drug firms in the United States, has never been a supporter of the Chemical Weapons Convention. In 1997, Rumsfeld opposed it and, indeed, has been an advocate of the use of both chemical and gas weapons as a staple of the American military. Chemical Donald's department wrote to the Independent on Sunday confirming their decision to use chemical and gas agents in Iraq, claiming that their deployment is legal. Last week, the United States Marine Corps told the Asia Times that CS gas and the disabling gases have been shipped to the Gulf and will be used throughout Iraq. Given that the entire war contravenes international law, does it matter? Gases that incapacitate in low doses will be used in high doses. They kill when they are injected into the rooms, as the Russian Special Forces found in October when they slaughtered 128 of the 700 hostages supposedly to be liberated from a Moscow theater. It is a detailed delineation in The Guardian, to its great credit in London. The chemical hypocrites is the title of an article, and indeed in the Wall Street Journal, Maya, on the 2nd of April, deja vu. In earlier debates, the United States has defended the use of chemical weapons. And in this article, and surprisingly in the Wall Street Journal by Cynthia Crosston, she details that for the entire period that chemical weapons have been available, literally since 1899, the United States has been foremost in their development and in their use. And they are described as following. Chemical warfare is the most humane method of waging war, argued Brigadier General Augustin Prentiss, head of the U.S. Army's Chemical Warfare Services, in 1937. The article details administration by administration, year by year, war by war, how the chemical weapon is the staple of the American arsenal, used in every conflict with abandon.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, April 8th, over WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, listener-sponsored radio in the tri-state New York region, and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Now, we mention the internet, www.wbai.org, because you can tell your friends, your families, and your colleagues throughout the world that they can listen to Taking Aim each Tuesday via the internet. Now, if you miss our program or you want to hear it again, we have an internet site at www.wbaifree.org. That's wbaifree.org/Taking Aim. You can contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net or call us at 212-209-2953. Our program today is Carnage, the Real Face of War. Now, we've been looking at the carnage throughout Iraq, but let's go and look at the strategy and the tactics that are being used in this war. An article appeared in The Independent by Justin Hugler on March 30th. In Baghdad, U.S. likely to adopt Israel's Jenin tactics. And what he discusses is that last year, in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And a very special person was giving advice to the Marines, Professor Martin Van Creveld, the Israeli professor of military history and strategy at Jerusalem's Hebrew University.
And a Mossad figure and an Israeli military intelligence figure who is at the forefront of crafting and articulating the plans for mass expulsion of the Palestinian people, first through attrition, then through devastation, and ultimately through forced physical removal.
Now, what Professor Van Creveld, Martin Van Creveld, was doing at Camp Lejeune was he was teaching the Marines about the Israeli tactics in Jenin. That is the precise tactics similar to the Warsaw Ghetto, because what we've revealed on prior Taking Aim shows is that the Israeli militarists studied the policies of the Germans, particularly what they did in the Warsaw Ghetto.
Well, Maya, they actually utilized the German command staff's battle plan for the Warsaw Ghetto as their instruction model, as reported in Haaretz and in Yedioth Ahronot, their instruction model for Jenin and for the Palestinian cities, villages, and towns in the West Bank.
And as Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, who Ralph calls the Hannibal Lecter of journalism, stated in an interview with Ari Shavit of Haaretz, he was quite open in his statement there, quote, "Actually, the Iraq war is a kind of Jenin on a huge scale. We will go from house to house in the Kasbah. And from America's point of view, Saddam's Iraq is Jenin."
Maya, that theme in Haaretz, and let us give credit to Haaretz, the Israeli mainstream newspaper, for its willingness to publish straight-up descriptions of what is taking place not only in the Palestinian territories that are being devastated, but in Iraq and in American policy itself. Running a lead article on April 4th called The Israelization of America, Gideon Samet writes as follows: "The events in Iraq are the Israelization of America. Close your eyes for 1 minute and you will see that the Marines in Karbala are the Golani infantry in Tel Karm, taking our tactics, taking our strategy, implementing our plans. Never has there been a war in which Israel did not participate, but in which its policies were being followed to the letter and which will impact so forcibly on its future." And this detailed article describes how the Israelization of America is from the perspective of Henry Kissinger and the policies that have been worked out over 30 and 40 years for the dismemberment of each Middle Eastern nation in its turn. What we have described repeatedly on Taking Aim, what we have written in detail about in The Hidden History of Zionism and Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, the plans for the dismemberment of the fractionizing, the compartmentalizing, the reduction of nations to their original ethnic and religious components, the colonization of each Middle Eastern country in turn. The Sharon, this article describes the Sharon, Netanyahu, Rumsfeld, Cheney nexus, which defines policy, the Israelization of American policy, not only in the Middle East, but on a global scale. Haaretz, the Israelization of America.
An important article appeared in the Asia Times that gives us a basis for understanding the Israelization of this war in Iraq, the Israelization of American policy. And it's by Hooman Peymani, and it appeared April 5th in the Asia Times. "Israel plans restarting oil pipeline from Mosul to Haifa requires regime change in Syria on to Damascus." And the Asia Times is actually referring to an article that appeared in Haaretz. And in Haaretz, it talked about, Haaretz had discussed with the Israeli National Infrastructure Minister, Yosef Peretzky, about the consideration of revitalizing a pipeline project that would reduce the cost of Israel's oil imports. Now, prior to the 1979 Iranian Revolution, Israel acquired its oil from Iran. And before 1948, there was a pipeline that went from Mosul to Haifa, and that supplied Israel with its oil. So what the Israelis are planning to do is to revitalize, to rebuild the pipeline from Mosul to Haifa. There is one problem with this. The pipeline goes through Syria. So consequently, the Israeli National Infrastructure Minister and others within Israel state explicitly that this would require, quote, a regime change in both Iraq and Syria. That is the prerequisite for the project. So here we have regime change, Syria next, according to the Israeli design.
Well, let's look at this in precise terms, Maya. James Woolsey, Clinton's director of the Central Intelligence Agency, is described in The Nation by David Korn in the issue of April 4th, the Pentagon CIA man in Iraq. And he states that Woolsey made headlines by telling students at UCLA that the Iraqi war is the first part of World War IV. Speaking at a teach-in sponsored by Campus Republicans and Americans for Victory over Terrorism, an Israeli and JINSA and Project for the New America sponsored group, and a particularly Iraqi group founded by William Bennett, Woolsey stated, "This Fourth World War will last considerably longer than either World Wars One or Two did, not for the full four plus decades of the Cold War, but close to that." He called for the United States to organize the change of regimes throughout the Middle East and let us make a lot of people nervous, he states, particularly Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and the Saudi Arabian oligarchs. "We want you nervous," he said. "We want you to realize that this country and its allies are on the march, that we are going to remove you, that we are on the side of those who do not want your regimes in power." He told the world, he told the crowd in the states, David Korn, "We are in World War IV, and this war will continue for decades." And this theme was elaborated upon by Richard Holbrooke last night in his interview with Charlie Rose on CBS. And it should be pointed out that Holbrooke was Clinton's ambassador to the United Nations and a point man for the devastation of Serbia and of the Croatia and of Bosnia and of Kosovo and the fragmentation of Yugoslavia. Richard Holbrooke to Charlie Rose: "There will never be democracy in Iraq. It is years away, if ever. Let us put that out of our minds. What we are really dealing with here is the threat to our entire value system by radical Islam who want to wreck the global village. As James Woolsey pointed out, this will be a longer battle than the Cold War. This is but the first stage. Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, Harry Truman, John F. Kennedy understood regarding Islam that this is a long and sustained battle that we will maintain until we have prevailed, war after war." From Woolsey to Holbrooke, from the neocons to the Clinton security apparatus of James Woolsey and Richard Holbrooke, it is imperialism in crisis visiting devastation and permanent war on humankind.
This Sunday in the New York Times, David Sanger, in an article entitled "Viewing the War as a Lesson to the World," wrote, quote, "Shortly after Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld issued a stark warning to Iran and Syria last week, declaring that any hostile acts they committed on behalf of Iraq might prompt severe consequences, one of President Bush's closest aides stepped into the Oval Office to warn him that his unpredictable defense secretary had just raised the specter of a broader confrontation. Mr. Bush," writes David Sanger, "smiled a moment at the latest example of Mr. Rumsfeld's brazenness," recalled the aide. "Then he said one word, good, and went back to work." As Sanger says, this was from a senior administration official, and Iraq is not just about Iraq.
And the newspapers of various countries are now elaborating on this theme. On the Toronto Star on April 5th, The Shape of World War IV by the Numbers. And it cites not only the plans of Woolsey, but the support of this by the Bush administration, and a war that will liberate millions across the Middle East is our founding promise, said George W. Bush. World War III was the Cold War, the article quotes James Woolsey. It will be decades while World War IV unfolds. And this interesting article in the Toronto Star runs the numbers, as they call them. The percentage of the estimated military spending in the world in 2002, $850 billion, 50% spent by the United States, 0.15% spent by Iraq. If anything indicates and measures the disparity, this so-called war, this turkey shoot of destruction of the population of Iraq, is these extraordinary numbers.
Is North Korea next? Asks John Pfeffer, March 24th, in an article in the Interhemispheric Research Resource Center. Quote, a serial invader is always looking over the horizon for the next target. The U.S. doctrine of preventive war flies in the face of international law, so-called international law, I will add, and justifies invasion anywhere, anytime. But what John Pfeffer notes is that if you look at the Bush administration policy right now, you will see that they're laying the groundwork for the next move, an attack on North Korea. And he goes into detail. He notes that the heavy machinery is already in place. Recently, 24 long-range U.S. bombers were moved to Guam. And as part of a recent computer-based command training drill, the U.S. aircraft carrier Carl Vinson, six F-17 Nighthawk stealth fighters, and an Aegis warship arrived in South Korea for the first time in a decade. He said, the Pentagon is playing with the idea that if it acts soon, it can take out North Korea's nuclear reactor without contaminating the region with radiation. By the way, this is the very strategy that Israel did when it launched an assault against the Iraq's nuclear power plant, and as Richard Perle stated explicitly in interview after interview, this is the appropriate policy of preemption.
My watch next, U.S. sets sights on Iran and North Korea in the World Tribune on April 4th, elaborating on what you've just described in the aftermath of Iraq. Taking on Iranian nuclear weapons will be of equal importance as dealing with the North Koreans themselves, Assistant Secretary of State John Bolton stated. He told a conference of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee that the Iranian nuclear weapons program will receive high priority for a follow-up to the war in Iraq, stated John Bolton. And indeed, last night on NBC, the, quote, terrorist analysts Stephen Emerson, Bob Arnault, and Dana Lewis reported the following. On NBC, the United States forces have discovered something called Hezam. Is that Shazam? It's Hezam. What is Hezam? It is the, quote, Terror International of Baghdad, the funder and organizer of Hezbollah in Lebanon, together with the Syrians. The Terror International of Baghdad, according to NBC, embraces Egypt, Syria, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, who are preparing a jihad. And in keeping with this, NBC stated that after the deliberate targeting of Al Jazeera, which killed Tariq Ayoub, Al Jazeera is supposed to have reported the infidels are attacking Al Jazeera. The infidels. Al Jazeera never made such a report. Al Jazeera reported the deliberate targeting of the journalist centers of the Palestine Hotel, the deliberate killing of Tariq Ayoub with the targeting of Al Jazeera's offices, and the hitting of the Palestine Hotel, which killed German and other Spanish journalists as well as Arab journalists by design. Now, the news report of the Telegraph on the 8th of April today, Syria is now the top U.S. target for regime change, the Pentagon's next target for regime change. Amid the charge that Syria has allowed Saddam Hussein to transfer weapons of mass destruction across its borders into Syria. The new pretext, the new lie, and indeed they quote Ariel Sharon, "We are certain that Iraq has moved its chemical and biological weapons into Syria. World War IV, the pretexts in place, the preparations elaborated, the war in Iraq, but their little beginning."
And, Ralph, I think it's important to go back to the fact of what the Israeli infrastructure minister said. Israel very much wants to rebuild the oil pipeline between Mosul and Haifa. Now, sometimes when you go to business magazines, you know, the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, and Forbes, you get an inkling of what the next stages of armaments in the genocidal policies of the United States are going to be. Now, snuck in the massive defense appropriation for the war, the $74 billion, by the way, Donald Rumsfeld said before Congress that half of that money had already been spent, there was money allocated for the testing and the development of the mini-nuke, the nuclear bunker buster bomb. But in Forbes.com, on February 27th, it noted that the San Diego-based Hollis Eden Pharmaceuticals, in collaboration with the armed forces, that is the Pentagon, has been developing an immune system booster. And the purpose of this immune system booster, which would be in further inoculation of U.S. troops, is to fend off, quote, the toxic effects of radiation, and would be used by troops going into battle. And this could be ready as soon as next year, in time for an assault on North Korea.
North Korea and the U.S. on a slide towards conflict rights. Tracy McVeigh in the London Observer on April 6th. And details what you have been describing, Maya, the preparations for America's preemptive strikes against Korea. 600,000 soldiers under arms in North Korea, and the U.S. is preparing for a major preemptive strike. And indeed, in an important article by Joshua Micah Marshall in the Washington Monthly on March 27th, chaos in the Middle East is not the Bush Hawks' nightmare scenario, it is their plan. Across the border of Iraq, in Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, our conquering presence has brought preparations for the next stage. Saddam is charged with moving his biological and chemical weapons to Syria. When Syria denies having such weapons, the administration masses troops on the Syrian border. Knowing that Hezbollah has cells in the United States, the article quotes Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, the nation will be on permanent orange alert, and FBI agents will sweep through the United States with new rounds of arrests of Saudis, Pakistanis, Palestinians, and Yemenis, and American citizens alike. To the Bush administration, the hawks who are guiding American foreign policy, this is not a nightmare scenario. It is everything going on as anticipated. And the article cites the Weekly Standard's Jeffrey Bell report that the U.S. administration has in mind, quote, a world war between the United States and Islamic fundamentalism, a war of such reach and magnitude that the invasion of Iraq or even the capture of al-Qaeda's commanders is but a tactical event in a series of moves and countermoves stretching way into the future. Each crisis will draw U.S. forces further into the region. Each countermove will allow the United States to take its troops in country after country until the U.S. soldiers rule the entire Middle East. Chaos in the Middle East, the hawk's nightmare scenario, is the Bush administration's plan.
Carnage, the real face of war. You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net or at our voicemail 212-209-2953. We also have a website, www.wbaifree.org/takingaim. Contact us for copies of today's or other programs or our books, such as The Hidden History of Zionism and Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed. I'd like today to thank Bradley Wiedmeyer, without whom it'd be difficult to put on these shows, Erica Bridgman, our engineer here in the KPFA studios, and Matthew Finch, holding down the fort at WBAI. We'll be with you next week. I'm